wants to dance and drink all night. Well, there's no one that can stop her. She's going till the house lights come up.
Welcome to After the Deluge. I'm Justin Cox. New Wave is Against Me's fourth full-length record and their first on a major label, Sire. It was produced by Butch Vig and released on July 10th, 2007. It debuted at number 57 on the Billboard 200, and it was Spin Magazine's number one record of the year and Rolling Stone's number nine. In previous seasons of this show, all the episode intros were just annotated Fire Joe Morgan-style excerpts of Pitchfork and Rolling Stone reviews, but up to this point, Against Me was fucking around in scenes largely ignored by those pages. But that changes with New Wave. It was widely reviewed, heavily anticipated, and finds the band on MTV and traditional radio. The Pitchfork review is more a speedrun through their trials and tribulations than it is a review, but this quote drives home a very real point about this record and where we were as a listening public at this time, I think. In a post-indie rock world where the Decemberists and Death Cab for Cutie and even Mastodon were cheered for making the major label leap, writes Zach Baron, Against Me became the first band of the 21st century to actually succeed at selling out. And I just think that's a notable quote because we say that kind of thing now often, but to say it in 2007, you're kind of in the middle of like that real, real change. Like we're in peak like iPhone commercials and stuff coming up right then. And amid all of that, Against Me manages to sell out. Like people get mad. It causes waves, you know? I mean, all of this is in the Dan Ozzie book, which gives a bird's eye view of all of it, and it's not coincidental that Against Me is the final chapter in that. And the resulting album is New Wave, which, funny enough, first episode of this show was with Frank Turner, loves New Wave. Next one, Austin Lucas, loves New Wave. Another musician who we're talking to today, loves New Wave. I would say that this record's reputation is far more complicated than what I just laid out, but it's a massively important record whether you absolutely love it or have complicated feelings about it. My guest today is Ben Lee, a musician and songwriter born in Australia. No joke, this conversation has stayed with me for the past week. As someone who loves to indulge ideas and create things, I'm often prone to the external forces that made Against Me's ascent kind of messy and difficult. And Ben's approach to art is almost entirely liberated from that. He has a very crystal clear and sort of fluid outlook on all these things. So the story goes, Ben downloaded New Wave to his old school iPod before a long flight to Australia on the recommendation of his friends Tegan and Sarah. He was aware of the band, but it was on this flight that they would blow his mind. And by the time he touched down in the motherland, he decided he was going to cover the whole record. We talk about all of that and more. If you want to support this show, hit up patreon.com/afterthedeluge, and you can find me as well on social media at Routine Layup. Here is my conversation about New Wave with Ben Lee. Come on and wash me. Ben Lee, welcome. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
So glad to have you. I'll say something really quick. The thing about this band is I think that it's been cool to watch how people pick them up where they pick them up. So it could be in a Florida basement, and then it could be 2 years later in a small punk club, and then it could be a couple years there along the way, people are finding this band. And when they tend to find them, they grab on really hard. You know, they take to it in a really passionate way. And so I'm going to let you tell this story yourself, but for you, that's New Wave, and the lengths, the effect on you is so much that you make an album of those songs. How does this happen? How did this?
Yeah. So I'd heard the name Against Me. I was aware of the band. I kind of keep up with the music press and I don't investigate everything and listen through it, but I kind of keep up with what's going on. But it was when New Wave had just came out and there was that initial big, you know, wave of press, and yep. Because I've been longtime friends of Tegan and Sarah, that mm-hmm. connection was really interesting to me. And, you know, it's funny because Tegan and Sarah were big fans of mine back when they just started out. And so it's a funny thing to say, but I kind of trust their taste.
Nice. I love that. You should, as you should.
You know, it's that kind of thing when someone says they like you, you're like, well, I like you too. That was an interesting endorsement, because I knew this band Against Me was sort of this abrasive punk band. And the fact that there was this connection to Tegan and Sarah that really have a much more traditionalist approach to songwriting and their career. And it's quite tender and right. quite romantic, that it really made me interested in, and the idea of a duet, because, so this is all before I listened to it, that duets are, they're sort of an outdated.
Oh yeah.
Songwriting in a way. It's something very associated with the 80s.
And this duet really feels like Summer Nights from Greece style.
No!
Yeah, I hadn't even listened to it, but I just loved everything I read about it. And it's funny how the era of reading about things first before you hear them is a little bit over, because everything now can be so hyperlinked so quickly. And I don't think I had a Spotify account when New Wave came out.
I think Spotify is 2 years away from being even really a thing at all.
Right. So I would have like read about it and then decided, did I want to invest in downloading it on iTunes or something like mm-hmm. that? So it's quite funny, but that's how a lot of my musical loves came to be, through reading about them first. Like I remember reading about Nirvana, and the way it was described, I was so interested in, that everyone was saying it's like Black Sabbath meets the Beatles. And it's funny, because when I got Nirvana, I didn't think it sounded like that at all, really. Like, I'd become a fan of what I imagined in my head. But anyway,
it's a titillating enough description to be like, okay, I need to go hear that.
So it's a fun.
I try to protect myself real quick with that. I like, it's something I value in like year end lists and things like that. It's like, we don't need to be ranking these like the top 100 necessarily. But the 200 words about the thing is a chance to discover stuff in a way that's like, I'm going to go actively find that rather than be algorithmically fed it. I long for it a little.
Yeah, well, I mean, unless you're sitting in a room with someone and they're like, you got to hear this shit, it's normally someone's got to give you an elevator pitch on why something's worth listening to. So anyway, I remember I was on a flight to Australia to do a promotional tour for my album Ripe. And I downloaded New Wave on iTunes and I listened to it on the flight. And I was just blown away. I just fell in love with it. It touched me and I think you're right in terms of which eras of an artist's career reach out to you. There's a reason for that. I am, in some ways, it's funny because I do have quite left of center tastes, but I always like the REM quote, where the acceptable edge of the unacceptable. I always liked the populist version of the weirdest shit there is. I have tremendous respect for the distillation of complicated messages into something digestible.
I can't sleep, driving eyes wide open.
I mean, I think that I like it in movies. It's like they did the job of making a thing that is just is very approachable, but also this is smart and different. And I don't know, the REM quote you said sums it up pretty good. No need to.
And sort of where it hit in this particular moment of my career, my wife was you know, a couple months pregnant. I was on this, you know, it was quite an interesting, exciting, stressful time. I was about to put out a record that sort of had quite a bit of pressure on it. And for me, one of the ways I've always stayed centered is just to do more creative projects. Like if I shift into PR mode too much, I get just like nuts, you know, when you're just doing interviews or something. So by the time I'd gotten off the plane, and I think I'd read about Ryan Adams had covered the Strokes album in its entirety. So it was kind of, and it had never come out, but it was kind of in my mind, this concept of covering a full album. And I remember pretty much when I landed, I reached out to Nick Johns, who I'd been collaborating a lot with at the time. And I was like, do you want to cover this whole album? It is this gorgeous pop record. And I just think we could do it really beautifully. And he started whipping up tracks and we were going back and forth. And I basically did it all in hotel rooms around Australia while I was on a promo tour. Are you restless like me? Are you restless like me? Are you restless like me?
It's like stunning to me. I was trying to like orient myself yesterday. Like you mentioned Ryan Adams and the Strokes thing. And I think Ryan Adams did a Taylor Swift one that did come out. And there's who is it?
I think Adam Green did the Libertines.
Oh, cool.
Hearing that. Yeah.
I'm like trying to think of like real precedent for this because your cover album, it's within months of this album coming out, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I understood implicitly also the stickiness of that as an idea that if you're going to act on these things, you got to do them when the conversation's happening. Yeah. And that's become increasingly true. I think that in terms of the way virality works on social media, like the window of conversation gets shorter and shorter. Yeah. But I always knew that for this to have any real effect, I needed to act fast. This was a record that I was not the only one who was hugely excited about it. And I've also like, I like to use whatever moderate sized platform I have to turn people on to good stuff. And I like to throw my weight behind artists I'm a fan of. And it just felt like I needed to act fast and do it and act on the inspiration.
Oh yeah, I'll put it in the intro, but there's something, I think on the Bandcamp page, you have like the message for like why you did it initially. And you articulate something along the lines of like, maybe this will introduce people who like my music to Against Me. Maybe this, there's sort of like this, like, I don't know, there really is something there. And your approach to covering them really does unlock and allow me to hear different things that I didn't like necessarily gravitate to on this sort of big sounding Butch Vig record, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. That's great. Cause I did hear, I mean, that we can get into the songwriting, but what I heard in the songwriting was this amazing mixture of understanding the traditions and the rules of songwriting with a completely uncompromising commitment to the lyrical content that was specific to the artist. And I just thought that tension and that, it was just so beautiful. It's like someone who, it reminds me of, have you seen Hearts of Darkness, you know, about the making of Apocalypse Now?
I have not.
Oh, you should see it. It's a great documentary. But there's an amazing scene where Dennis Hopper is like, I don't want to learn my lines. I want to forget my lines. And Coppola says to him, you can forget your lines once you've learned them. And I think that's true with all kinds of technical abilities, that what I heard in this was actually a deep understanding of how to write a pop song.
No, yeah.
And a choice to do it a little differently. And that to me is where things get really impressive.
I think that you articulate that perfectly. And that ability to write those pop songs existed when it sounded borderline like shit in Florida basements and stuff. It was like the song just shines through. And what's interesting about on this record is you have this other production. And then within those songs that you're talking about is like this weird meta conversation about the production. Like they're talking about like snapping it to the bass drum kicks, and like there's this real like sort of like meta criticism of like authenticity and art and music and everything happening in the songs while making these beautifully crafted and produced big punk songs.
Absolutely. Sometimes I'm not sure if it's criticism or if it's just questioning.
That's better. Yeah.
And they decided to go for it in that moment, you know? And it's interesting because Tegan and Sarah had already done that. Tegan and Sarah had gone for it. I forget which was the record they did that was the big pop record.
Yep.
It was quite, I think that's also what I related to with the band, because in my own way, I was interested in doing that. The record I was putting out at that moment, Ripe, I'd made at Village Recorder Studios with John Alasia producing, who'd done, you know, John Mayer and sort of big sounding radio.
Yeah, yeah. Stuff.
And I had a lot of people say to me, if you just went a little more slick with the production, I think your music would get across to more people. So I made a real choice to explore that too. And it is something that, particularly if you come from sort of having roots in the underground or punk rock or indie rock or anything, it can be a bit of an embarrassing or cringy exploration just by nature, because it's very vulnerable. The whole thing is based on the idea of you going, okay, what if I admit I want more?
I'm going to try.
So it's so embarrassing. It's so vulnerable. You now, it doesn't work, you know.
you have stakes. You have you've admitted you care.
Exactly. So I just really related to that. And, you know, it reminds me of sort of REM and Nirvana and I think The Replacements. I mean, a lot of great bands that had massive commercial potential but came from the indie side of things had very conflicted dances into bigger production value because they really, you know, we all come from an era where selling out was a real thing. It's not a thing anymore.
I know.
But at that time it was a real thing.
Yeah. It's about as white hot as it gets in the conversation around this band.
Yeah.
What I think is interesting though about you covering this record is there's a certain sort of low stakes version of that now that seems like a thing that someone would do now, where you just be like, recorded the record, did it on my laptop in my bedroom, it's on Spotify, that there was no overhead, there was nothing. But 2007, that's you put it on a site for free for download, download the MP3s, or it just seems like a more of a go out of your way to make that lift. And it also was I looked, it's within months of when Radiohead put out In Rainbows in that similar type way.
I think the conversation about, and this stems from what I loved about indie rock initially, it was tiny labels where everybody was in each other's bands. You made lots of work. You put lots of work out. You failed fast, failed cheap, fail often. It was just
the
way you did music. And I would get, when I started in the early 90s, I'd get a letter saying, hi, we have a fanzine in France. We want to make a cassette with our next copy. Do you want to give us a song? And I'd sit in front of my boombox and play something and send it to them. And so that's where I come from. So yeah. I sort of see it as the industry has kind of caught up to punk rock. The principles that we made things by are now normal. That's now how hip hop works, and even pop, people just dropping surprise releases.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Interesting collabs, and like you said, sort of low stakes or playfulness to it.
How do you as a musician, through that evolution and change? You sound, the way you spoke about it just now, you sound like you move pretty fluidly with it. Today's the day that Spotify Wrapped came out as we talk.
My daughter just shaped mine, and it's funny because it's a mixture of my songs and her songs because we always listen in the car.
Yeah.
So it's very funny. It's my top songs are Baby Keem, Orange Soda, and Steely Dan, Dirty Work.
Yes. Good job. You know what? That's so funny because my kids absolutely fucking annihilated mine this year. All the songs are theirs, but it's good because you got maybe this is questionable parenting, but you have Bob by Outkast, Bombs Over Baghdad, and you have Seven Nation Army.
But wait, I interrupted you. You were saying, yeah, today's Spotify Wrapped, so this is how the industry's moving, right?
It's just there's a line in the song, I think it's Up the Cuts, but in MRR, which is Maximum Rock and Roll, someone asks the question, with the instant availability of information and content so easily obtainable, is the culture now a product that's disposable? That's wild to me that's written in 2007. I think that's a thing you'd say about where these things go now. And I don't say that with any
It's also what they would have said when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan.
I guess you're right. I guess it's the constant
has moved towards convenience. I mean, Dead Kennedys, give me convenience or give me death. this has been an ongoing movement that generationally there's a lot of like tutting about. I personally, and this goes back to the launch of LimeWire and Napster, I have found on a survival level that I do not want to put my energy into resisting where distribution of music and the way music is consumed is going. I think fighting that is, to me, it's like, sure, maybe we definitely do need, like, you know, the Umore and all these people like fighting Spotify for better residuals and transparency, and that needs to be done. But just personally, I need to be making work and figuring out how to pivot as the industry changes. And in that way, I'm a bit ruthless. Like, hey, if it's moving on TikTok, I'll go to TikTok.
Yeah.
You know, I'm interested in surviving as an artist, and I'm very unapologetic for that. So yeah, look, I do have some, we had, you know, on our podcast yesterday, we had Aaron Rose, who had a Ledger gallery in the 90s, where it had like Harmony Korine, Mark Gonzalez and Ed Templeton, the whole skate art punk scene, like basically came out of his gallery. And we were talking about tangible objects and how beautiful they are. Like when someone gives you a book or a record, uh-huh. But at the same time, we love culture now and we love AI. And we're kind of excited to see, put that in the hands of real creative people and let's see what happens. And so I just don't bother spending that much energy critiquing where culture's going. And I always think, well, how can I use it to my advantage to be the artist I want to be?
Damn, that's gonna stick with me for a little while. That seems like a good way to navigate an artistic life.
You're doing it. This is a podcast. You know, this is a medium that didn't exist. It was just starting to exist 15 years ago, whatever it is. It's like you want to speak the language of your generation.
Yeah.
You could do this as a print interview in a fanzine, but you're well aware no one's going to read it. It's more like...
Damn, you're right. Okay, good. I'll take that. Well, it's fascinating, like what you just described. There's a certain fluidity and openness there, and sort of like a self-determined, like, I need to do what I need to do to make this a thing that can work. I'd say that is the opposite of the way the first four or so records of Against Me play out. Like, they are feeling, not necessarily like moving to streaming, things like that, but all the external pressures of who they are, what they should be, how big they should be, what they should sound like, and everything. And I think that like the culmination point is New Wave.
So I don't know if you know this, but when my version of this came out, Magnet Magazine sent me to, I think it was Cleveland. I was in the middle of a tour. I had a day off. They flew me to Cleveland to interview Against Me for the cover of Magnet. So that was the first time I met the band. And one of the interesting, during the chat, we had a great conversation. Because I think we came in with a mutual respect and an admission of differences, you know, and part of the differences were what made my version interesting, you know, that if I'd have been exactly the same aesthetically and morally, it would have been a copy. But one of the things we talked about was about what you were willing to do or the types of shows you were willing to do to be exposed to more audience. And they said they had a rule that, and it was a joke, but it was true at the same time. They said any tour that was sponsored by Hyundai, they would not do, because that was the time where like there was like Maroon 5 and I don't know who it was, like, and I was like, oh really? I would like open for Maroon 5 in a second. Like, I would just think of it as there's about to be 20,000 kids exposed to someone. I'd rather that be me than someone corny.
Yeah.
And Laura said to me, well, I think we're different. I think we're different in this area. And it wasn't in an aggressive way. It was like, we wouldn't do that. But I think this line moves through your career too. You know what I mean? Yeah. There are things you start out saying you'll never do and you do, you know.
I bet honestly their answers are different now than they were then, as they should be. Yeah, like, no one is the same thing over their entire lifetime, but you got a whole world shifting around you too. You shouldn't be the same.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. this morning in preparation for this. I just put it on while I was doing other things. And I was kind of expecting to jump around and like just listen to a little bit of each song. And I listened to the entire album beginning to end because it deserves it. It is, I couldn't believe it. And it wasn't even like, there wasn't even any fat within the songs where you get to like a triple chorus at the end and you're just like, okay, we know what's happening here.
We got it. Yeah.
It was like the arrangements are so tight.
You were transported back to that flight to Australia.
Loved it. It is still as good a record. I don't know. I mean, everything I pick just sounds so obvious. New Wave is amazing. Up the Cuts, Thrash Unreal. I mean, White People for Peace, it was interesting, and Americans Abroad in the current context of sort of activism and Americans seem in a way more willing to question their sort of kind of national identity or national values than ever. They seem quite prescient.
With guns and ready, drawn and aim, inside us playing to have got the bless them with strength and courage. And it was in his name, artillery lit the sky on fire. The people sang protest songs, trying to stop the soldiers' guns.
What I love about this record too is Animal and the Ocean are like, they're like the two kind of weird ones in a way. But that is the archetype of the great rock album. Like, you gotta end with a couple long weird ones. And I think it's almost like the understanding is so deep of what a great record should be. And I don't know how much Butch Vig was involved in that in terms of helping curate what the songs were or anything, but it just seems that as a team, they had a really thorough understanding of how to make a classic album.
Yeah. I think The Ocean is amazing, and I liked it even from the beginning. And I was one of those people that was like, oh no, what is this next version of Against Me going to be? And I heard Thrash Unreal, and I fucking loved Thrash Unreal instantly. And it did this kind of job of like, I'm good. And then when I got into the record, there was like a slow feeling out process, and like certain songs grew, and I found my way toward loving this record. Oh, The Ocean is one that feels different, but I loved immediately. Animal, I felt different about. Animal was like a long, weird one, but the thing I liked was the way the chorus opens up, the way that like your record does a good job of like, you do it. I love your take of that song too.
And I, it is interesting that this was right before this tremendous milestone in Laura's life. And obviously there are Easter eggs like throughout this record of all of this stuff that was going on behind the scenes and in the inner psyche. It's a historical document.
I agree. You talk a little bit of talking about the songwriting. There's this thing that Against Me manages, Laura Jane Grace, the songwriter, that is like, a chorus will just be a sentence, like a literal sentence with no rhyming scheme or anything whatsoever. A notable one being "No mother, other dreams that her daughter's going to grow up to be junkie." That's the chorus on your single.
What a weird chorus. That is so weird and so intentional. You know, like that's a great example of, and it feels so good to sing. It doesn't feel like a depressing lyric. It feels like you're just like, yeah.
It's true.
Even the name Thrash Unreal, like, it's just so clever.
It's good. And well, what's fucking crazy to me is that she manages that a lot all throughout their whole discography. And then also certain ones where it's like, at the chorus of this one, we're just going to say versions of "Hey" or "Whoa" or like literally no words at all. And on Thrash Unreal, but you could, I mean, maybe what's your interpretation? The chorus is "No mother ever dreams that her daughter's going to grow up to be a junkie." The chorus is also "bop, bop, 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 da, bop." It's like those things over each other. It's literally both of these things at the same time I don't know. They pull it off in some super special way.
To me, that goes back to someone like Lou Reed, who was interested in finding the space between bubblegum and expressing the seediest truths about humanity that you could all in one song. And it's a grand tradition of that sort of thing. I mean, yeah, Nirvana did that. Like, just artists who understand what a hook is for.
Yeah,
the hook is the sugar to help the medicine go down.
Yeah. And I mean, that contrast of the big buoyant feeling thing that upon further inspection is saying something else, just it only heightens both of them.
Yeah.
An interesting one is stop. I was like, you come to realize stop is basically like a mantra, right? Like it's like, it feels that way. It's like, she's saying that to herself. Here's the scene around her that her world is now. Stop. Take some time to think about what's important to you.
And it's perennially true. Like, look at social media now, how reactive it is and how people just speak before thinking. And also how the punk rock scene is like, in some ways, what's so amazing about it is the impulsive release of rage and emotion, but realizing that has to be balanced with cognitive, processing. Yeah.
Stop, take some time to think, figure out what's important to you. Stop, take some time to think, figure out what's important to you. Stop, take some time to think, figure out what's important to you. Gotta make a serious decision. Stop, take some time to think.
I watched your something in like a little prep lead up to this. And it's how I know you definitely are constantly exploring what music is out there. As I saw your like Amoeba Records, What's in My Bag, and half the records you picked out were like, I don't know what this is, but I'm intrigued by it.
I'm that type of listener. I don't generally like to listen to the same things over and over. I like the experience of it being the first time I hear things.
Yeah.
I just think there's different types of listeners. So for me, it's a voyage of discovery.
I'm inclined in your direction, but admire your level of it. Well, so take that. You put New Wave on the iPod, you start your flight to Australia, you're listening. Is that what you come away from that wanting to cover it and loving it. Is what is jumping out to you on that? Like the structure, the pop songs, the songwriting, like, is that the thing that you're locking into as you're listening to that and falling in love with the record?
I think so. I think it's the melodies and the lyrics. I mean, songwriting is such a weird thing because, you know, there's a famous story about Phil Spector being interviewed right when Be My Baby came out. By sort of an AM radio DJ who was really square and was like, let me read these lyrics to you. Be my baby. Be my little baby. And he's like, how is that art? And Phil Spector goes, you're missing the beat. Point of it is that like it's not poetry, you know. Right. Songwriting is not poetry. Songwriting is not classical composition. It is a specific art form that is more akin to like Mad Men, like people writing jingles or something like that.
Yeah,
doing it in ways that are surprising and interesting and hooky and get stuck in your mind. And I think it's just like, you know, game recognizes game. Like songwriting is songwriting. I can hear it in any genre. And I'm like, that's it right there.
It's kind of I love talking about this as it relates to this band and in general, because it's sort of like a little mini mission within making this podcast series to zoom in on the part where this is a brilliant genius songwriter, because I think people know that, people understand that, but it's a punk band at the end of the day, you know? And so you're not thinking of it necessarily in that way, but it's a punk band with like, essentially one person holding an acoustic guitar are the roots of that punk band, and you hear it all the way through all of this. And she's just an amazing songwriter, and it goes all over the place. It's not none, it doesn't sound the same across records or on individual records, you know.
Who's an interesting person to think about as a comparison is Trent Reznor. who, until Johnny Cash covered Hurt, like, I'm in the songwriting community. No one ever talked about Trent Reznor's songs. I never heard it. It was like a band that did like dark videos, and obviously kids loved it and whatever. But then when Johnny Cash covered Hurt, suddenly everybody from like Ben Folds to Amy Mann, to, you know, everybody was just like, whoa, that's a song.
There's a song in there.
It's funny how it takes something like that out of context sometime for people to see past the persona and the artifice or the production and hear what's really going on.
That's a good point. I'd be curious, like, in real time, if people were saying that about Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. Like, when Nevermind came out, were people like, this is a genius, brilliant songwriter? Or was it like, holy shit, this is changing music? And these, I have to imagine some level of like, wait, no, this is like a pop songwriting genius. That like full conversation kind of like ballooned as time went on, I'm guessing. I don't know.
I think in the industry, but particularly by the time of Unplugged, by that point, everyone was on board that like, this is our generation's John Lennon. And I think it's really interesting with, you don't have to have that in music. You know what I mean? Like the Strokes, who are a band I like a lot, I don't think Julian Casablancas is that. He's not someone who other people cover their songs and they sound amazing. He's like a brilliant rock star that fronts a brilliant band.
Yeah.
And it's great. You know what I mean? But it's something very specific when you talk about the level of craftsmanship of someone like Kurt Cobain. It's just not attainable to everybody.
When you talk about the sort of like, we're trying hard and it's going to come with stakes. We signed a major label. We're going big on something. What on the scale is literally having the guy who produced Nevermind be the producer of it? Like, how much is that?
It's a statement. It's a statement. It says, here come the big leagues.
All right.
You know, I do think that must have been, I don't know, it would have been interesting. I was not in the fan base or in that conversation, but I imagine when that news came out before people even heard the music, I'd be curious how fans were responsive to that.
I think I'm enough of a Nirvana kid that I was like excited. It was like, well, fuck, yeah, give that treatment to this band, sure. And once I actually heard it in practice, I remember missing a certain level of like messiness. But the like, I think really in what I felt it was like the drummer on previous albums, same drummer, felt like he was like, all right, we're playing. I'm playing. I'm not thinking. I'm just playing. And there's even some quote where like the band talks about like not incorporating math like into anything. We're just playing. And then when I listened to like the drum beat on Born on the FM Waves or Up the Cuts, I think I feel like I could hear the sort of like the thing that like AC/DC does, or a band's playing bigger spaces, like leave more space between these hits. Like these are set and planned. And there's a certain level of that that like is fucking awesome. And I love, there is also this certain thing that feels deliberately different that I remember like needing, like trying to pin down why something felt different and trying to figure out how I felt about it in the moment.
Retrospect now, where does this sit in terms of you who like loves their whole body of work, and like where do you put this record?
I'm gonna say it's probably like fourth, maybe third. That's a question I need to answer in like 2 months after I finish all of them, because they all, I just did Searching for a Form of Clarity, the record before this, that I thought, I love some of the, has some of my favorite songs of theirs, but I thought, it's long and it's the only record of theirs really that feels like it has moments that drag, because this record doesn't feel that way at all to me. Like you said, this morning you put it on, it just, it's carrying itself through, you know. But then I was listening to it for the last few days. It didn't feel like it dragged. Maybe like two little parts if I try to be like critical of it or something like that. I don't know. It's a really fun process to like revisit. It's like speed running your 20s and 30s or something by way of music and culture or whatever.
You listen to Jokerman podcast at all?
It's Bob Dylan, right?
Yeah, but it's interesting because their whole thing was about beginning their interest where he lost critical favor. So it's basically about the records he made from the late 70s through the 90s until present day. And it's about, it's trying to do what you're talking about doing is like actually listening with sobriety of an adult,
yeah,
as opposed to the reactionary thing of a young fan and going, hang on, if we admire these artists, we have to admire their whole journeys, not just the bits that are like sexy to us.
Yep.
There is a great, I think a need, it tackles the issue of ageism in our cultural narratives where we're like, oh, people don't make interesting music after 30, which they probably don't make interesting music to 20-year-olds, but they do make interesting music to people who are in similar life stages.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's just a whole, I think it's a really interesting conversation.
Totally. I love that. I've was aware of that podcast, but haven't listened to it, but I am going to. How, like, what's interesting is like for everything, like what I just said about you're aware of Against Me, but you're locking into this record and really like fully taking cannonballing in with this record. I did that with As the Eternal Cowboy, which is two records prior. They had an EP and another record prior to that. And so for anyone hearing, there were people that would be like, oh yeah, when I heard what they did on As the Eternal Cowboy, I was like, how come you're not playing a fucking broken guitar in a laundromat and singing about anarchy anymore? So mine's the one that is like everything to me is the one that they're conflicted on, which is then me when New Wave comes out, give it all time. And like you just said, strip yourself away from whatever youthful like story you're telling the world. And you just realize like, holy shit, this band's amazing.
You also know what the story is that you are telling as an artist and when you're in the middle of it. Like I have the same thing because I've been making records for 30 years. So I have people that are highly attached to certain eras and they view that as my pinnacle. And to other people, they're like, dude, there was like a decade before that. And other people, they were like, oh my God, this is so much better after, you know, whatever it is. But what I've realized is that the long game for my career is that like I meet young artists now and maybe they like one of my records more than another, but more than any of that, they like the way I've done my whole career. And I'm realizing that is actually a bigger message than any one record. And that's something you don't realize when you're in the middle of a journey, that the way you're flowing through it in a way is where the integrity lies.
What you're describing about the way your career is perceived really shines through. Cause like I know many songs and especially in the last couple of weeks have listened to a lot more, but even without like deep, deep knowledge of all of your music, what you just described is like a thing I think I knew even before messaging you.
And I think the thing. Like I didn't realize that. Like you get so hung up on each project and you're like, oh my God, they've got to get this one. If they understand this record, they understand me or whatever. You realize that like even before music, there was the human psyche where I want to share some things about a way of looking at the world. And I'm using music for that. And I don't need anymore the audience to understand every little bit of music. It's like, those are kind of for me and my friends and the people who make it. We have a great experience. But what I really want to share is in a way like my value system. And I think that's really all we can share with each other that's really effective, you know?
Damn, Ben, this is all good. How does that play out when it comes time to, how does a 30-year career with people latching on to different pieces of it play out when you got to sit down and make a 14-song set list?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a balance. I've gone through periods of being more extreme, gone to periods of like, I've got to, like when I do a festival show, it's like in Australia, I'm sorry, I've got to play like all songs people know, I can maybe squeeze one in, you know. So I'm in reality about that. That's the price of admission. If you get paid a festival check, you've got a festival show. The rest of it is I try and I feel like I've reached a point where my audience that still comes because they don't, some people come for periods and then they don't keep going to shows, but the ones that still come, they actually aren't coming to hear any one particular song. They're coming to like vibe with me for the evening. And as long as I'm in a space where I'm like feeling creatively connected and emotionally present, it goes well. It doesn't really matter what I play or what arrangements or what musicians I have with me or not with me, or, you know,
it's a good place to be. All right, to pick up the point I was making a minute ago, like this record was reviewed well. It was number one album in Spin magazine, number nine in Rolling Stone magazine, got charted for the first time for them, everything like that. So that's all there. I think in a lot of ways, it's a critical success and a commercial like sort of success. I think maybe not enough for the record company to really invest hard in the next major label debut. So there's a whole story that'll come there. But it's generally in its like new audience that they're penetrating, really positively received. But there is this other thing where it's being, where it's not, you know, there's this whole other stuff. Were you aware of any of that?
I've listened to every record that Against Me and Laura made after that, because it's the kind of, once you have an experience with a band, you know, it's something I'll always watch. And you can feel it. I mean, I could feel that I'm aware enough of the industry that that record was an artistic triumph and did not do what the label probably needed it to do. I mean, had it, because, you know, I've also toured, I toured with Dashboard Confessional, who went through kind of a similar arc where they were meant to be the next U2.
Yep.
And anything short of that is a failure, because you're talking about just huge amounts of money being invested. What can you say? You know, these are the adventures, they're cautionary tales, they're mishaps, they're things we watch in the industry, and they happen to all of us. And there are times when we, in a way, once you try and play the biggest game of all, you're kind of destined for failure. You can't stay at the top. You know, it's just so hard.
it's simply not a well-calibrated goal to say this album is going to be Dookie or Nevermind. Or
But what's cool about it is, had they not tried, we would have never had Laura's insights into the hero standing in the eye of the storm in that way. So yeah, you don't win every battle, you know, you don't achieve all your goals, but I think there is something noble in watching a songwriter ask those questions.
Yeah. And it just is, it's so additive that quite literally the album is basically narrating that that conflict, that moment. It's like, you don't even have to know you don't even have to read about the background of it or watch a documentary or whatever. You can just, it's in the music on this record, the previous record, you hear that struggle is being navigated. And all the insiders rumor about the decline in sales. All the policies happening in the digital marketplace. FBI warning printed on the flip side. Under penalty of law, first you will be prosecuted. Can you tell me about the kitty cat on your record cover of this?
That was my website design. I was like, can we put this up? He's like, you should probably have a cover or something. I was like, any ideas? And he said, what about this? And he said to me, I was like, absolutely perfect.
Cute little kitty cat. I love it.
It was back when we had website designers. We weren't just doing it ourselves. You
know? God damn. I mean, it's kind of true that like you said, website designers, a bunch of money going into a record to try and make Against Me the next whatever giant band. A lot of this stuff is kind of gone now, right? Like the way you talk about it, kind of circling back to you recording into a tape player to send off to a French zine. There's like this period in the middle where everything just tried to swell up bigger, like post Nevermind, post Green Day, maybe, that now is like, it feels like the stakes are lower. Like, I'm not even sure anyone is signing a band and saying, we're trying to make you that now, right? They're signing someone based on a following they already built on their own.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, the industry is, it's been through a lot of growing pains. And, you know, we're now watching the film industry and TV industry go through kind of similar types of things. Yeah. These are issues to do with the maturation of a vision of what it means to be a musician, what it means to be success, what it means to be, it's very tied into capitalism and questions we're asking now collectively about, are we in a sustainable economic system? If we're not in a sustainable economic system, how could we have a sustainable music industry? It's like the wrong battle to complain about the music industry. It's like the foundation of it, of like needing to make more and more and more money might not be able to make any system healthy in a way. So there's fun things that you get to go through with those big swings, with the corporate power behind it and the cars picking up from airports and the expense dinners and all that kind of stuff. And they're character building. These are character building things for artists to go through if they survive. If they don't, they're character destroying.
Have you ever played anything sponsored by Hyundai?
I still aspire to. There's still
it's gonna happen. I did learn in this process that your wife, who I feel like I know a little from listening to your podcast, Weirder Together, directed an Against Me music video, right?
That's a beautiful video. Cause for a period, me and Laura shared a manager, Danny Goldberg, and Ione had just directed one of my videos, and I guess Laura was looking for someone, and Danny was like, you should get it. And Ione was so happy, and Natasha Lyonne's in it.
I know.
It's our house here and our neighbor's house, and it was awesome.
It's really good video. And I was like, holy shit, that's Natasha Lyonne in a Shapeshift With Me album music video. It's awesome.
Credit to this guy Nick Johns. It's so funny. He's this musician I played with for a lot of time in here, but he's like not on, he doesn't have the most ambitious approach to his career. So like you can't find him on anything. He's just the guy making music all the time in his house. But he did most of the music for it. And it was, I think he did a really beautiful job and did it really quickly. So that's just someone I want to give credit to. Yeah, my stuff. I've got a new record coming out next year that's a really fun album. I did actually recorded it to tape. It's I did it with John Worster and Jason Narducci, who are the rhythm section for like Superchunk and Bob Mould. And
oh shit, you
know, so we did like a three-piece power pop record called This One's for the Old Heads, and that's coming out next year. And then yeah, we have me and my wife run a company called Weirder Together, and we put out like our podcast Weirder Together, as well as like Jello Biafra's podcast, Lou Barlow's, Brock Enright's, a great new podcast called Subtle Urban Sex Appeal. We put out music and throw parties, and I don't know. It's just creativity. The same energy of like me making that the whole album cover is the way I kind of do everything. It's like, got an idea? Okay, let's execute it. Because I just realized like execution is the magic ingredient to achievement.
Yeah. Well, I want to see if I can ask this question. You seem like a good person to ask it, but I was thinking it the other day. Probably will come out clumsily. But like, what do you think of viewing a life as like an art project? Like your life itself is an art project. You're making things. This is what feeds your energy. I have similar feelings about it. But what I wonder is like, is this the healthiest way to live life? Because this is what feeds you and you're in the process of making things. And that's like literally you make that fundamental and foundational. Or is it like overly turning your life into a thing that always needs to yield things? And that should be a compartmentalized off thing you go do that is not your life itself. Did I do it? I don't know.
Oh, it's funny. It reminds me of there's that Bright Eyes lyric. It's nothing I would recommend, but it is one way to live. we're essentially talking about management strategies of how to manage life, which is a chaotic, complicated, emotional thing, you know? Yeah. And I think living it under the concepts of it's an art piece is a good idea, but even that has its limitations. Like there's a story I always remember. It's like this Eastern European fable about this guy who goes to a piano master because he wants to learn piano, and he sits and he has lessons and he practices week after week after week. And one day he says to the piano teacher, why does it always sound better in my head than it does coming out my fingers? And the master says, what makes you think that ever changes? And I do think that is the innate limitation of art, that in a sense, we're trying to touch something that's inexpressible. And so you can live your life as art, but it will still be an approximation of something that is deeper, that is intangible and is hard to really say, but that's the beauty of life.
You can do all that you want. Dancing around in your head, but the process of making it a thing is going to involve compromises and changes and limitations and maybe differences that improve it too. And
that's where culture exists, because we fail over and over. And that's the context I would understand this album into, especially in terms of its commercial, the arc of it, that it was designed to do something and it achieved some of that.
Yeah.
And that's how life is.
I mean, it's a little bit like this format of a podcast, which, by the way, the previous season went through Bright Eyes' full discography and interviewed Connor at the end of it. It feels like you just realize like, oh, a record is like, it's almost like these just little lily pads through a person's life that you get to be like, this is where they were here. It's certainly true of Against Me, but everything from politics to the record industry and scene drama and everything, then obviously to like gender and issues related to that. It's like, it almost like comforts me to be like, oh my God, someone is like deliberately curating and documenting in this way. And I imagine you have that, you feel that way about your life to a certain degree, right?
Not every artist makes that type of records. That's probably the ones you're interested in. They're the ones I'm interested in too. I view musical acts as they either in the perfectionist camp or the journal camp.
Yeah.
And I like the journal camp. I like artists that put out lots of albums, and I don't have to fall in love with everyone, but they're telling me where they're at.
Yeah, cool.
I like that. The perfectionist ones, you know, which are more in a way like even like the Billy Corgans or someone like that, who's like, everything has to be like super, super high stakes. Like everyone is, I don't know. It's just, to me, it's not, it doesn't speak to me in the same way as like a Bob Dylan or a Conor Oberst or someone that just like kept it going and take that journey. And you're going to have favorite bits and not favorite bits, but I don't need you to tidy up the meaning of life for me in order for me to understand it. I like it messy. Give me the whole thing.
Gosh. Well, cool. That invigorates me in terms of making a podcast like this, and because it's really fun. And honestly, it's like a little therapeutic to like to go through it. I love it. So glad to have you. Weirder Together, Ben Lee album coming out next year. Any social media or anything like that you want to tell people about?
Music on everything, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter. Yeah,
Bentley music on everything. Cool. I'm gonna play us out to say the name of the guy who helped with all the instruments on your
Nick Johns.
The arrangement of the ocean, the sort of introductory instruments on the ocean, like they borderline sound like some like Radiohead OK Computer type feeling thing. So I'm gonna play us out to that. Ben, thank you so much.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening. If this is your first episode of After the Deluge, you should go back and check out episode 1 with Frank Turner and then follow the Against Me discography back to this point. And if you like Bright Eyes or Jackson Brown, we have seasons about them that precede this one. So thanks for checking it out. If you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/afterthedeluge. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend.